From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour, starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nnamdi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter with NBC4 and a columnist for the current newspapers. Tom Sherwood, welcome.
Good afternoon.
Also joining us in studio is Brian Kenner. He is the district's deputy mayor for planning and economic development. Brian Kenner, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
If you have comments or questions for Brian Kenner, you can start calling now, 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org, or you can go to our website, kojoshow.org, and watch the live video stream there. You can also send us a tweet at Kojo Show. Before we get into the show, I have an announcement about next week. Next week, D.C. Metro Police Chief Kathy Lanier will be joining us, and we are inviting you to join us in WAMU's Black Box Theater for this occasion. We have a limited number of spots available on a first-come, first-served basis. If you're interested, you can email our producer, Taylor Burney, at tburney, that's T-B-U-R-N-E-Y, at WAMU.org. Don't we get a fanfare for this?
You know, maybe fire the weapon. You know, she's only fired the weapon once. She shot a dog. She'll tell that story.
Okay, that's next Friday in our Black Box. We'll see you then. It's tburney at WAMU.org. And Tom Sherwood, before we get to the snowstorm that's coming, we had the snowfall that occurred on Thursday night.
Wednesday.
It was Wednesday night.
The days just go by when you're having fun.
When we were at our Hacks and Flacks events,
yes.
It started snowing. I saw a guy take a fall on the sidewalk outside. That's when I realized.
Well, that could have been for reasons other than the ice.
No, it was clearly the ice.
Right outside
man was
Bus
sober.
Boys and Poets near Catholic University.
The man was sober. But that's when I suspected that something.
Well, you know, that was a problem for the entire region. Maybe the deputy mayor here will comment on this. But, you know, the entire region didn't respond properly to the Wednesday night icing. Chuck Bell at NBC4 told us, he said the weather service let out the notice at 11:30 that morning that it could be as much as an inch of snow. It turned out to be 0.7 of an inch. And he said the region just didn't pay attention to it. He said he thought so because the regional people were looking forward to the storm we're about to get now. And we looked ahead, as he said, to the Super Bowl rather than the playoff game.
And everybody else was doing the same thing. Is that your understanding of what happened, Brian Kenner?
Yeah, that's, you know, I think the mayor has made some comments about, you know, the city's response and maybe should have been better. I know lots of people experienced some traffic delays and some slippery conditions. I mean, I think, you know, Tom is right that everybody in the region, certainly from the district's perspective, I think we're looking forward to being prepared for this weekend. We know that there are serious life and health and safety issues that could present itself, and so I think that we want to make sure that we've got heating centers and we've got people off the roads so that we can do plowing and pre-treat and those kinds of things. And so I think that, like some of the region, we were also very focused and continue to be very focused on what's going to happen now.
And one of the things that's not going to happen this weekend is that Metro will not be around at all this weekend. I remember during what was called Snowmageddon in 2010, and Metro was the only way some of our producers could get over here because Metro was still at least running underground during that snowstorm. This time, nothing.
It still is, but it's still a pretty big system above ground, and they need the tunnels to store their cars, the vehicles, the cars. But I want to get the deputy mayor to comment on one thing, because while I've been waiting here, I got here early for the show today, and I've been looking out on Connecticut Avenue and tweeting pictures of cars being towed off of Connecticut Avenue. It's a $250 fine on the emergency route, $100 for the towing. And some people complain, oh, the city just wants to make money. But that's to prepare the city for tonight and tomorrow. You've got to clear the lanes. Is that?
That is absolutely correct. You know,
this is talking to the former Tacoma Park city manager,
that's right.
So he knows what he's talking about.
Yeah. So we used to do. I mean, even in my previous job, we used to do towings on snow emergency routes. I've been through 7 snow events in one winter before, and so. It is, trust me, it is not a money-making operation or incentive. What the incentive is that there's lots of equipment that's got to get up and down on snow emergency routes. Those are the primary arteries in and out of our city, the most traveled routes. And so the idea is to make sure that those are completely clear so that we can get safe streets back. You know, I think that every car that's added to one of those emergency routes just increases some of the potential areas that we can't salt, that we can't plow. And so that's the real
And we are so used to seeing those snow emergency route signs that we forget that they're even there after a while.
That is true. The fact that they're there, you kind of blend in with the scenery, but also there are some concerns that there aren't enough of them. And just before the show, we were talking about, and some people who are foreign language speakers may not recognize that those signs are there and what they're for.
Well, you can be fined up to $250 for leaving your car there, but apparently...
And a $100 towing fee.
Apparently we are, at least I am not going to be fined for not shoveling my walk within 8 hours of the end of the snowstorm. How come?
This is one of the most longest running problems in the city. In the past, that you had to like go to court for the city to get you to be fined and have the shoveling done. Then this council passed a law, which went into effect just for this season, that you can be fined $25 if you're a homeowner if you don't shovel your walkway within 24 hours after the snowfall stops. Commercials, 100 businesses, $150, 8 hours, I think, of daylight after the snow stops. The problem is, the mayor says this storm is going to be so big, she's only going to give out warning tickets, but the warning tickets weren't printed, so they don't really have them to give them out anyway, so you're not going to be fine. The mayor said instead she's urging people two things. One, if you help your neighbors on the sidewalks. The city government will try to do city property. But also she has 2,100 volunteers who were given snow shovels to help out in their neighborhoods.
Is it true that your reluctance to shovel your walk is what led you from living in a house to living in a condo complex?
Yes, well, yes, a co-op complex. Thank you. There is a difference. But the fact is, you know, I always tell people I moved to my retirement home. It's no yard work, no steps, and no snow shoveling.
That's why he moved, all right. That's in case correct. You're just joining us, our guest is Brian Kenner. He is the district's deputy mayor for planning and economic development. If you have questions or comments for him, call us now at 800-433-8850. Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with Terry McAuliffe. He is, of course, the governor of Virginia. The state of emergency that exists now in D.C., Maryland, and Virginia, the city will essentially be shut down. What effect can a major snowstorm like this have for the district economically? There were conventions planned here, other major events. What kind of effect?
Yeah, I mean, you know, and again, Washington's no different than, you know, Chicago or New York. Sometimes when you have these really extraordinary events, I mean, again, put this in context. I mean, I think I saw that there are 30 million people that are sort of in a blizzard warning right now. So this is an extraordinary sort of event. And so, yeah, you know, we've got some events that were happening this weekend. I think the car show is an example in the convention center. We're supposed to begin this weekend.
Delayed to Monday.
That's exactly right.
For the public to get there.
Because I think the convention center is actually going to close. I know that the BET Honors was going to be shot here this weekend. They sort of have postponed that. So, you know, I mean, we sort of work through those issues. You know, the thing that I like to remember is that a few weeks ago I saw people in flip-flops and sunglasses, right? And it's one of the warmest Decembers I think we've had on record. And, you know, I saw plenty of outdoor seating in times when I'm sure that there was no forecast and restaurants were bustling. And I'm sure that that sort of helped overall in our tourist season in December because we had such warm temperatures that people could come here and could be out, you know, spending money and doing things. And so, you know, you just have to take these things in sort of cycles a little bit. I mean, this is an extraordinary event. I think that we will make our way through it the way that many people did in 2010 and 2011 with Snowmageddon. And, you know, I think that ultimately we will we'll be better off for it.
Unfortunately, there are a lot of people, moderate income or even low income, who have jobs, you know, the restaurants and all, they lose money. They can't work. The restaurants close. I mean, a lot of people have jobs where you can take leave or you can be paid even if you don't come to work. But there are literally thousands of people who, one, depend on buses, which won't be running after 5 o'clock tonight, I think it is, or Metro, which runs until 11 o'clock tonight, then shuts down for the weekend. And they really do have a lot of hard work jobs that they have to have. So I feel sorry the most for, not sorry, but I hope that they can manage as best they can in this snowstorm.
Yeah, I mean, I think that puts the burden back on, you know, jurisdictions, the region, and the district, you know, obviously in particular here, by getting the streets back
to clear those
streets and sidewalks, right? I mean, those are the two things that are going to get people back to work as soon as possible, keeping people off the streets this weekend so that the people can do what they need to do.
And right now, you know, the March for Life, the anti-abortion march,
starts
covers
at
every
noon or 1 o'clock
there was
today.
A big gathering at the Verizon Center this morning, and I was asking all week about this because, you know, they can have 100,000 and more, a couple hundred thousand for some years. And Chief Lanier told me, she said, they have the right to march. They've got the permit, and they say they're going to march regardless of the weather this afternoon. But she said, if we have to clear the streets, we will clear the streets.
Yeah.
Well, we learned late last week that Walmart is pulling out of two stores it was supposed to build in the district, one in Southeast, one in Northeast. We had to put a seatbelt on Tom Sherwood so he would sit in his chair during this. He was so agitated as a result of it. But, Brian Kenny, you and Mayor Bowser met with Walmart representatives a week ago. What was said at that meeting, and what was this in any way expected?
Yeah, I'll try to couch my words perfectly because I've got some personal thoughts about it. But
well, yelling is allowed here.
Okay, good. You know, the short answer is that no one was aware. I mean, Walmart literally made this announcement, I think, Friday morning. Up and until then, not only did the D.C. projects that were impacted, which is the Skyland Town Center project in Ward 7 and the East Capitol Gateway project in Ward 7, not only did they not know, but it was part of Walmart's larger announcement last Friday that they were closing 300 stores nationally. They were effectively cutting 16,000 jobs. And so, you know, outrage and disappointment really doesn't begin to articulate this. I think when Walmart originally decided that they were coming into the District of Columbia, they had sort of announced these five stores. I think everybody, including the community, sort of anticipated that these five stores were going to be opening. And so, it's obviously incredibly disappointing. Yesterday, I had an opportunity actually to go out to the community. So I actually spent about 5 hours at two different community meetings yesterday in Ward 7 talking specifically about the Skyland Town Center project, about the East Capitol Gateway project. We also had Deputy Mayor Snowden, the Deputy Mayor for Greater Economic Opportunity, that was also there. The development folks were there to really answer questions from the community, and they are outraged as well.
What can you do, if anything, to
yeah,
get
I mean,
these stores back on track?
You
the
know,
Mayor talked about she might try to quickly, and you, I guess that would be you, mm-hmm. would quickly try to find maybe another major tenant to anchor these places.
Yeah.
Is that where we are? We have to go forward?
We absolutely have to go forward. The primary focus right now is to find additional retail tenants. And the good thing about I think, both those projects is that they had retail interest before, so it wasn't like Walmart was the only potential tenant that could have gone in there. You know, the community members had questions about what's going to happen with the construction progress because, again, for the East Capitol project, most of the site work was already done. Actually, they were pretty much ready to do vertical construction in a very short time period. Skyland Town Center was a little bit farther behind, but people are asking questions about what's next. And I think, you know, the fact that we're less than or about a week away from the announcement, there's still some questions as to, you know, how construction is going to continue or at what pace. What are lenders going to do? But, you know, our primary focus and something that we even started last week with both the development entities is who are going to be the additional people that we can find to replace Walmart.
Is that site far enough away from, say, the Lowe's and Northeast Washington, the South with Lowe's? I mean, it seems to me that's the type of store that needs to be over there. As much as
I think there's lots of potential options. I mean, Walmart, the configuration of Walmart at both the sites was going to be north of 100,000 square feet. It's pretty rare that you find a 100,000 square foot single anchor mm-hmm. tenant. The kinds of other establishments that tend to be in that same footprint are Lowe's, Home Depot, Target, Costco, Wegmans, you know, those are the kinds of retail anchors that are north of that. So it may be one of those. It may be a compilation of smaller tenants. Right. You know,
I just have to say I was so irritated because I told the mayor Vince Gray, who got this deal as part of the agreement for Walmart to come, was to put a shop at Skyland. And I kept telling him, you know, Mayor, they're effectively dragging their feet. I know there's a lot of issues that they didn't have to deal with, but still. They didn't. I said, you know, when you leave office, they're not going to build that store. And there may have been other reasons why, but they're not building the store. It really is a slap where we most need retail and jobs more than any other place in the city.
What have we learned from this, Brian Kenner? Are there better ways to negotiate with large corporations?
Seal the deal first.
Yeah, you know, the thing that I think I've learned from this, and this is what Walmart has directly said, not only to us in private meetings, but, I mean, I think in their conversations nationwide, you know, the store store closings in Ward 7 are what they call representative of their sort of pullback from urban markets. I think that if you look at their store closings, they're also closing some stores in Chicago, Los Angeles. They're closing the Baltimore store. They came into urban markets in a big way in 2011, 2012, all across the country. And I think they're finding that it's a different, perhaps, business model than what they anticipated. And
are the three that are open? I was at the Ridge Road Walmart yesterday looking at them. People were pretty busy there, although one of the employees complained that they don't sell enough local goods, like just athletic shirts for Georgetown or other schools. They're still just a national firm.
Right.
And there's one on Georgia Avenue, and there's one downtown off of North
Capitol and H.
North Capitol and H. And I'm told, well, Walmart said those are underperforming. Is that true?
You know, I can't speak specifically to if they're underperforming. I mean, I think that there are, there are lots of opportunities in each one of those locations that you mentioned, the Fort Totten one, George Avenue one, which obviously gets lots of traffic up and down George Avenue, both from Maryland and from the District of Columbia, and even the North Capitol store sort of being that burgeoning east end of Washington, D.C. And so, you know, I think they've talked about some of the challenges that they've had in urban markets all over the place, which would include those three stores or include pretty much all the stores they have in urban markets. What we have continued to stress to them is that, you know, we feel like we've got great population growth in the District of Columbia. We're sort of moving in the right direction in lots of key economic indicators. And so, you know, we feel like there's lots of progress still to be made and reasons why they should not only consider obviously, the three stores that are existing doing well, but also potentially also the two stores that they've talked about closing.
Our guest is Brian Cannon, the district's deputy mayor for planning and economic development. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter with NBC4 and a columnist for the current newspapers. Don your headphones, please, gentlemen, because Chris in Washington, D.C. has a question. Chris, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Chris, www.dc4reality4. Just wanted to ask Mr. Kenner, can't quite understand this. This concerns the land disposition agreement. How do we keep entering contracts with these companies regarding our public land? Because remember, Skyland was about 20 acres of public land. The city put $90 million into this deal. The deal was consecrated, as I understand, last November, just a couple of months ago. Why didn't Walmart tell you they were considering not doing this deal before the city sold the land to them just 2 months ago? And how can they promise and continue to make all these promises to the city, these developers and these corporations like Walmart, and then somehow just be able to walk away? This was not a handshake deal, as I understand. There was a lease in place. They broke their lease. And the city sold this land only a few months ago. How can your office continue to allow these companies to get away with this sort of just leaving things behind, and now we're just disappointed? No, there has to be some teeth in this. Am I wrong?
Well, you know, I appreciate the passion, because I mean, I heard it last night in the community meetings that I was a part of. You know, I know internally in the government we felt it and continue to feel it. You know, just some clarifications on some things. So the city does not have an actual agreement with Walmart. The city for Skyline and for the East Capitol Development Project, which is actually on Housing Authority on land, has an agreement with each of the development entities. Then in turn, the development entities then look for potential retail anchors. And so each of the development entities for those two projects had signed agreements with Walmart. And, you know, there are legal and financial implications as it relates to Walmart breaking those potential leases. But, you know, it's one of the things that somebody told me the other day. You can't sue somebody to open. You can sue for damages and legal other things, but you can't sue somebody to open. And, you know, one of the things that I think I've learned, you know, sort of throughout this process is that there's a speed and execution that we need to have in mind when we're trying to find and finalize deals in the District of Columbia, because these kinds of things happen. You know, I want to be clear that retailers pulling out of markets is not a new thing. As a matter of fact, in Washington, D.C., if you go back to, you know, all through the 90s, it was a common thing. Grocery stores used to pull up all the time out of communities. And so Walmart pulling out of these two locations grand scheme of things, it's not new. It's just a little bit new because in D.C. we haven't felt it over the
before
past
we move
years.
On from Walmart, we got a tweet from Ethan who says, when residents wanted to codify Walmart's promises in a CBA, a community benefits agreement, they balked. We should have known they never intended on keeping them. Was that a sign?
Well, you know, I think it's pretty rare for an individual retailer to enter into a community benefits agreement. What Walmart did enter into when they came into the District of Columbia was something they called a community partnership initiative, which at the time, and it still might be one of the largest allocations of money in this case, it was to nonprofits in the District of Columbia. It was $21 million. They're about $15 million into that, meaning they've spent about $15 million through their foundation on hunger, food, and some other sort of key initiatives for them. And they've told us verbally that they intend to honor that commitment and reach the $21 million.
Well, some people think Mayor Gray should have gotten, say, to build Skyline first because they added Skyline only because he said if you're coming to D.C., you've got to add Skyline. And they balked. And now people say they've got three really good location stores. They don't have to worry about the economic development elsewhere. Can we make a quick announcement about Arena Stage? I just got a tweet.
Go ahead.
I can't resist. I got to say no sweat. Sweat, the program that's at Arena Stage Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, have all been canceled because of the snow.
Where do you want to go next?
Well, I'd like to talk about soccer.
Okay.
This week, it hasn't gotten much news because of all the weather. The soccer
DC
team,
United's DC, new soccer stadium, slated for Buzzard Point, is in the design phase.
Yeah, Noel, they put out a design, and I'm telling you, it looks like some kind of Little League park. I've heard nothing but complaints about the – it can't possibly be a $150 million stadium for soccer. It looks like something they put up overnight with trailers.
Is that a question
that
or a comment?
No, that was just a rant.
Okay, good.
No, a lot of people have said – I saw the picture when they made the deal, and the mayor's worked hard, and you've worked hard to get that in place and to go forward. But this design that they've put out, it looks like kind of – looks like the Prince George's Equestrian Center.
And I doubt whether the district has any approval process for the design, but the district is still apparently in the process of acquiring the land.
Yeah, we've got, there's one parcel that we chose to pursue eminent domain on, so we actually have title to it, but we've still got to...
Chip Ackridge's
That's the Ackridge parcel. Right. But, you know, going back to the design, you know, I know lots of people have thoughts and feelings about design and what it should look like. You know, I mean, I'm a big English Premier League fan, and so, you know, when I see lots of soccer stadiums in that league, you know, they actually look kind of similar to it, and so that's why I don't try to go there. What is important to me, though, about the stadium is that, you know, I'm not trying to make sure that we have a stadium that looks good for today, but it's something that's going to be in a community for the next 30 years. And so lots of the questions and issues that we've been talking to DC United about are about how do we make sure that we've got good fan experience, good flow. How do we make sure that stadium will have certain kinds of connectivity with the communities that are not there today but will be there in the next 10 or 15 years? And how do we make sure that we've got safe places around the stadium, places for people to congregate, and places that visually look interesting? Because it's not just going to be a stadium where people are going to come and leave, but it's literally going to be something that's going to be stuck in a community and a part of that community for a long time.
Do we, meaning the city government, have any authority over what they actually design and do? I mean, I think the design element doesn't have to go through the National Capital Planning Commission and all that.
It's got a whole host of regulatory.
My concern was, as my understanding, part of the deal was that the owners would spend $150 million on a new stadium. That was the number that everybody said in all
press
releases.
That's correct.
Is that a $150 million stadium?
You know, Tom, I'm telling you,
it looks like something.
I mean, yeah, beauty is in the eye of the
beholder. Can they get by with – you know, some people thought they didn't have enough money. They'd come back to the city anyway and ask for money to help build the facility. And I know you'd say no to that at this moment.
Correct.
But do they have to spend $150 million or can they spend $25
million? No, they're committed to spend their $150 million.
Well, we'll see how they do it then.
And speaking of whether or not they could come back to the city, last year Mayor Bowser announced a deal for a new sports facility at the St. Ease facility in Congress Heights Southeast with the Washington Wizards practice facility. There's a lot of debate about sports stadiums and the cost benefit for economic development. District has agreed to pay a big portion of that stadium project to the tune of, I think, $50 million. What's the reasoning behind it?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think that, and, you know, it's sometimes I hear these comments, and I know that nationally it's also a topic. You know, I know that in L.A. they're getting a new football team that's out there. you know, for D.C., I mean, I tend to just try to be pretty specific. So, you know, I've seen, and I think lots of people have seen, the impact that the Verizon Center had in downtown D.C. And, you know, it really created activity. It was a demand generator. It created people. And it was located at a metro station, which we wanted to utilize in terms of sort of building building commercial and building other office and ultimately residential around that, creating a community. You know, the same sort of thought process, I think, went into St. Elizabeth's 5,000-seat arena, as well as a practice facility for the Washington Wizards, as well as a permanent home for the Washington Mystics, which is that this is, in a tagline that we've used before, this is bigger than basketball. This isn't just about a basketball or a stadium. This is about bringing 400,000 people a year to the St. Elizabeth's campus. St. Elizabeth's campus has been largely derelict and underutilized for at least 40 years. And, you know, it's located right at the Congress Heights Metro and right in Ward 8. And it's a place that we felt like, and I feel very strong, that we need to be making, you know, public investments in order to make a difference. And I think that, you know, this opportunity provides lots of jobs. It's going to provide potential commercial opportunities. It's a great catalyst for what we think our first phase development is going to be, which includes even more than 300 units of residential housing. So people are actually going to be living on the campus. And so I think that it's just a great catalyst.
And it sounds like a really good thing. And I know that even Georgetown University is interested maybe in some space over there for something. But there's also the concern that the lower income projects right across the street, like five or six buildings, I can't remember the name of them now, where the low income tenants there are concerned that they're being pushed out, that the owners of the buildings are allowing them to deteriorate, neglect, you know, demolition by neglect. Some other developers are trying to move in and make a profit on it. There's some real concern that while the good news for the city is you can get some development going, that the change in the neighborhood may hurt the people who live there now.
Yeah, and, you know, that's a concern that happens nationwide. It happens in Washington, D.C. every day. You know, there are some things, as an example, for the St. Elizabeth's first phase, there's an idea that was suggested by Councilmember Larubi May was, you know, creating a home buyers club for local residents to make sure that they have opportunities to stay. You know, the other great thing about our first phase is that more than 80% of our units are going to be affordable out of that 300 plus units. And so, you know, we are trying to be sensitive to these issues of what could potentially be rising property values. Again, some people like that. Some people will find that a challenge. We're trying to be thoughtful in terms of how we sort of mitigate some of those challenges.
That's going to be watching that. There's another major development project which affects the region, Maryland and Virginia, and that's the FBI. The General Services Administration today put out the official RFP asking for designs from, like, I think, four of the remaining developing companies to design the new billion-dollar-plus FBI facility that will go in Maryland or Virginia. Will we in our lifetime see something happen at the old FBI building downtown?
I would love something to happen in my
lifetime. What's the most optimistic? Maybe Walmart would like to build a store there. No, but optimistically, it will take 3-5 years or more for FBI to move. So we're talking like a 10-year period. We could have a stadium, football stadium at RFK before we get a new building down there.
Yeah, you know, anytime you start.
I noticed you didn't take the bait.
I didn't. You know, normally when we, you know, when you see large government agencies, and again, the FBI is a huge, office space user in our downtown core. Anytime you talk about the movement of that kind of real estate,
11,000 employees,
right? Anytime you talk about the movement of that kind of real estate, it's a long term process. It's never going to be a couple year process.
It's 3 years old now.
As a matter of fact, I mean, many people will probably remember, or maybe people have forgotten, that the FBI building originally going on Pennsylvania Avenue was an economic development play. It was a play to move into an underserved underserved area of downtown D.C. And that was also not an easy decision to make, and took about 10 to 15 years.
We want
to
move on to zoning here, because the D.C. zoning update finally passed last week. It affects accessory apartments, parking minimums, corner stores, expanded downtown. Starting with expanding the downtown area to reflect reality, what does that mean for zoning? Why does it matter?
You know, I think that the original zoning code that people have that we had been operating on previously was, I think, from the late 50s, early 60s,
about 50
I believe.
Years hasn't
yeah,
changed.
So, I mean, you know, part of the idea is that we needed to certainly update our code. And, you know, the interesting thing is that we sort of have gone in cycles as it relates to the zoning code. When that zoning code was written, I think we were close to 800,000 people or so. So we were a much larger city than we were back then. We also, I think, just demographically, were probably filled with more families, would be my guess. You know, today we've, and through the 70s, 80s, and 90s, sort of dipped down in population, 600, 650. We're now growing. We're growing about 1,000 people a month, and I think we're up to about 680,000 with projections that put us actually back to 800,000 people here in the next, you know, 5 to 10 years. And so I think that we wanted to make sure that we had a zoning code that reflected the growth and what we look like today. I think there's a lot more single people who live in the District of Columbia, probably less families. And so we wanted to make sure that we had a zoning code that was as flexible enough to accommodate sort of who we are now, but more importantly, who we're going to be in the next 20 or 30 years.
It's going to be interesting what happens when some of these millennials who have moved in decide to pair up and have children, and they won't want to live in those small apartments or condos of 400 square feet that are being built. But that's another, that's down the road for that.
It's down the road, but I mean, you've hit on a good point, which is that we also need to be thinking about sort of bedroom type diversity in the district, because we do. Our lifeblood is based upon people staying in the district, not just coming to the district, but we need for people to stay in the District of Columbia. And so we need to be mindful, and we're thinking about ways that we can increase that housing stock.
In the larger picture, we had a bus, an event at Bus Boys and Poet out by Catholic University, the Monroe Street Market. You look at what's happening along Yards Park. You look at what's happening on the Southwest Waterfront where I live, billions of dollars in development. You look at downtown. You look at the Events DC, which controls the D.C. Stadium area, all those hundreds of acres. What's going to happen over there? You know, some people want the Washington football team, also known as the Redskins, to come in and build a 70,000-seat dome stadium there. The mayor says she would like them back, but there's plenty of room for all the neighborhood amenities, parks, shopping, retail, that the people who live up there want. Is that possible? Where is the Skins thing?
Yeah, you know, I think that...
I don't know if you say the word or not.
Well, you know, I think that, you know, Events DC, who's the district sort of convention and sports authority, you know, they're going through, you know, what I think is a fairly exhaustive process now of looking at opportunities.
Yeah, reports due, isn't it?
It's due soon. I know that they've had some community meetings because they wanted to make sure that they got, you know, a decent amount of community feedback. I mean, one of the things that's important to me, and I know that Events DC shares this, which is that, and I know the mayor's talked about this too, is that it's not an either or. You know, having a stadium at the RFK site, which, you know, from an infrastructure perspective actually makes, I think, a lot of sense in the city, transportation and so forth, is not that's not the only option that could happen on the RFK.
We're running
site.
Out of time very quickly.
Okay, the mayor says there won't be acres of parking. So we're all very anxious to see what Events DC does. Will that be weeks or months before we see it?
You know, I think that we're probably talking somewhere between weeks and months.
One more. Your department is collecting data about the city, in particular about DC economic development. What is economic the economic intelligence dashboard? What's the idea behind it?
Yeah, one of the things that we launched here in January is just an opportunity for our office in particular to be more publicly facing about the information that we collect to make decisions. I get a dashboard every week in my office that tells me all kinds of statistics around employment, affordable housing, what's happening in our real estate projects. And we just wanted to have an opportunity to make that a little bit more public. Which has been great because I think that it helps with sort of transparency in how we make decisions or some of the information that we collect. It also, I think, does a great job in terms of inviting other people who have other data sources that we should be considering to also interface with us because we want to make sure that we have the most robust data that we can.
He is the district's deputy mayor for planning and economic development, Brian Kenner. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And he didn't say DMPED once.
What's
that?
The
deputy mayor for
planning and economic
development.
Oh, that's right.
You know, every let's time just, they say they should be made to pay $5.
Let's just call me Brian. Just call me Brian.
Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter with NBC4 and a columnist for the current newspapers. Coming up, Governor of Virginia Terry McAuliffe. Tom Sherwood, when you covered the General Assembly in Virginia, they never took a day off because of snow, but that's what they're doing right now. The Virginia General Assembly has called a rare snow day for
they're wimps. They're wimps. They, you know, these younger generation politicians don't know how to stay in filibuster age for, you know, 24 hours. No, the fact is they made a smart decision to not have a lot of session today, and they'll come back Monday. This is a big storm, and people do seriously have to be prepared. I mean, George Hawkins, who runs D.C. Water, has just tweeted out. He's telling people to fill your bathtub with water in the unlikely event the water gets cut off so you can flush your toilets. And then he says, quote, trust me, you will be glad you did. So people are really serious in the General Assembly, which is in a very, we'll maybe talk briefly with the governor about it. He's having a rough time with the Republican control.
Well, he is joining us now by telephone, Terry McAuliffe. Governor McAuliffe, thank you for joining us.
Kojo, how are you, buddy? Tom, how are you?
I'm good, Governor. We're... Have you filled your bathtub with water in case the power goes off in your mansion down there?
I think we're in pretty good shape. It's mostly underground wiring coming into the mansion. Remember, we're 203 years old, so we've had a lot of history with this thing.
What is Virginia doing in addition to prepare for what is expected to be a historic blizzard? You declared a state of emergency yesterday morning, as did D.C. and Maryland. What is authorized with that action?
Well, we moved very quickly. I started meeting beginning Wednesday afternoon with my team. I'm actually in the governor's command center now here on the second floor of the Patrick Henry building. On Wednesday, we deployed 500 trucks to Northern Virginia, 500 pieces of equipment to begin the preparation.
They should have used them.
They did.
Well, Wednesday night.
We had rock salt. We had 500 trucks going in Northern Virginia. And Wednesday morning, and then Thursday morning, I was the first state to do a state of emergency. And the reason you do that is, number one, it takes the weight restrictions off the road so you can redeploy, reposition your big trucks that you need to move. Hampton Roads, Norfolk and Virginia Beach are not going to get significant snow. They're going to get rain and wind. So we took all the heavy equipment. We moved it out of that region. And most of it is up in Northern Virginia right now. Right now, as we sit here, we have 13,000 pieces of equipment. We have 9,500 personnel on the streets, 650,000 tons of salt, and about 2 million gallons of liquid salt. I've activated the National Guard, 500 National Guards men and women. I just got a request for 200 more. I've just authorized that. Right now, the state police are handling 94 incidences. We have 44 missions going on by the National Guard. We have 1,300 people without power that we're dealing with as we speak. So we're fully deployed. We're on top of the situation. Bristol, Southwest Virginia, Roanoke have already had significant snow. Washington County has already had 8 inches, and it's moving up I-81. I'm very concerned, 2 to 3 feet potentially on Interstate 81. This road handles 70,000 cars and trucks every single day, keeping that open. And then, of course, Northern Virginia, as I say, we have a massive operation deployed as we speak, putting salt and salt brine down.
Are you going to be hunkered down there in the command center all through the weekend?
We are. I had some travel planned. I've canceled that. I'm here, and we have a command center just for the governor's office, which I'm in right now with a group of folks. And then we have our major center a couple miles from here in Midlothian, which is staffed by several hundred people, the state police, the guard, Dominion Power, FEMA, everybody. And I will go over to that headquarters tomorrow. But today I'm operating out of mine here, and we're monitoring. I have a big screen of TVs here. We have cameras, thousands of cameras throughout the Commonwealth that we're monitoring the roads as we speak and redeploying assets. But we're on top of it, 13,000 pieces of equipment.
What are you advising citizens to do in advance of and during the storm?
Grab a cold beer, sit at home, and watch some sporting events. Do not go on the roads. Listen, we've got the equipment. We're prepared for this. Please stay off the road. You abandon a car on a road, it really impacts the plows. It slows them down. They have to stop. They have to go around. It makes it very difficult to do what we need to do. And by Sunday night and Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, as you know, we're going to be back in the 40s. We can, if you let us get these roads clear, we will be back fully operational by the beginning of the week, and we'll be back to normal. But please stay off the roads. We're asking.
Our guest is Terry McAuliffe, the governor of Virginia. If you have questions or comments for him, give us a call at 800-433-8850. Send us an email to Kojo at WAMU.org or a tweet at Kojo Show.
Governor, let's talk about a big story today that the I assume you probably had a chance to hear about it. The General Services Administration here in Washington has put out a formal request for design ideas for the new FBI headquarters. You've got two sites in Northern Virginia where you've been trying to work to get the FBI there. There's one in Maryland. Are you up to speed on what that is? They're looking for these companies to say specifically what they would do with the money and how they would build a $1.2 billion FBI headquarters for 11,000 employees. I know you want it in Northern Virginia.
Sure, we'd love it in Virginia. I think most of the FBI agents today live in Virginia. We have, as you know, because of all of our defense military assets, the Pentagon, CIA, Quantico, all up in Northern Virginia, we have a lot of the black fiber, the dark fiber that you need. As you know, the FBI has a massive operation already in Quantico, Virginia. It's complicated, as you know, Tom, because the developers, I think there were five originally asked to come in. You would take over the existing facility in D.C. And be able to develop that. So you have to put that in your plans as you develop that and then look at the potential new sites in Virginia and Maryland. But we would love, obviously, to have the FBI based in Virginia. It's the place it ought to be. We have very low taxes, very business friendly. We're a great population of 8.4 million people. Many of them already work in the federal government, as I say, with the Pentagon and all the assets that we have. And most people live in Virginia because they do love our low taxes and all the attributes that we have. And it makes sense.
You know, this is the politics hour on that subject. You know, Barbara Mikulski, the warhorse there in the Senate, is retiring, and she's really pushing for get this done for Maryland before she leaves. That's a pretty tough competition in the political world.
And, Tom, I am not going to disagree with you on that. Listen, she has been a great senator, and I look forward to hosting her retirement party.
Well, listen.
She's done a great job for Maryland. And, you know, overall, she, as I said, not only for Maryland, but she's been a great United States senator.
I think she and Congressman Van Hollen, who has some little power there in the House, have both been working pretty hard to make sure Prince George's gets that facility.
No, I agree, but, you know, listen, I'd never bank against our great Senator Mark Warner and Tim Kaine, and as I say, we've had a great congressional delegation, and listen, it's an economic decision they have to make. We have, as I say, we already have the dark fiber that's needed. We have the military assets. FBI already is...
Well, don't go through that whole list again.
Okay, but I just want to make sure, in Quantico, that's where the FBI is now. So just, it's a natural progression, Tom. Okay.
In other news, you've got an unexpected supporter in the state Senate for your pick for state Supreme Court Justice. How important is it that Senator Glenn Sturtevant of Richmond said he will not go along with plans to unseat your choice for the state Supreme Court?
You know, I give this guy a lot of credit. I've been in politics and business a long time. I respect people who stand up, do the right thing, put the political consequences aside, but say, you know what, this is the right thing to do. And I give him tremendous credit for doing it. Listen, I appointed a justice who, I think we interviewed about 10 people. We were in consultation with both the House and the Senate. I asked them all to help with this pick. In fact, she was recommended to me by the chairman, Republican chairman of the House Courts and Justice Committee. But we went through the process. She was by far the number one most qualified. She's apolitical. She's a great jurist. She did the Malvo case, as you know, up there.
Jane Roush is who you're talking about.
Justice Jane Roush, who I think 22 years on the bench, just a distinguished career. So this Republican said, you know what, this is not right to treat this woman this way. She has served this Commonwealth distinction. And I respect people in politics who are willing to stand up and take a tough stand on what they believe in. And, you know, we need more people like Glenn Sturtevant, to be honest with you, who are willing to get out on an issue. You know, politics is, you know, it shouldn't be so ideologically driven like it is today. We need to get things done. And, you know, I appreciate people willing to do the right thing.
The Republican leaders of the General Assembly say the process that you violated the process, that they have an alternative choice who is also a very well-respected jurist. I can't think of his name at this moment. But that your recess appointment and attempt to do the recess again has caused the bump on this, and that you didn't consult with them on this person.
Totally false. That's political spin. We had an open, transparent process, probably the most open, transparent process. Everybody was invited. It was up on the website. Everybody was invited to be part of the process. We reached out specifically to the leadership of Republican in both the Senate and the House, and they basically said it is the governor's pick. When they're out of session, Tom, I get to appoint. So they can't dictate to me whom they want. It is my pick. And listen, what got them, you know, we had a special session. They didn't like that I called them back over the summer, but I was under a court order by the Supreme Court to bring them back to redraw our congressional lines. And sure enough, they now have been redrawn, and we need to move forward. I've got to do what I'm constitutionally required to do, but this fussing political temper tantrum that they threw has nothing to do about who consulted who. They wanted to get the pick. But you know what? The law allows me to do it when they're not in session. I'm sorry.
Republican lawmakers in the Commonwealth are using this General Assembly session to push back on gun control measures that you have put forward. They're considering dozens of gun-related bills for this session. You and Attorney General Mark Herring took executive action on guns. Could that have backfired in a way, causing this pushback that could actually loosen regulations substantially?
Kojo, you're missing a very important point. They can sign all, they can pass all the legislation they want. I have to sign the legislation, and I'm proud to say that I'm 27-0. I've not been overridden on a veto yet, and I will bet today, as I'm sitting here, that not one piece of gun legislation that I veto will survive. They can override my veto.
Yeah, actually, I knew that. WAMU Transportation Reporter. WAMU Transportation Reporter Martin DeCaro reported on comments your Secretary of Transportation made this week that you might sign legislation stopping the state from building toll lanes on I-66 if it reaches your desk. Some people are surprised that you would not fight to save the tolling plans that VDOT has been working on for years. Can you explain your position?
Whoa, Kojo, you're mixing up a few things here. Let's be clear. The plan that we're dealing with is my plan. We put it out. As you know, you and I have discussed this. We're not proposing new tolls for anyone. If you're driving for free today on HOV, it stays that way. The only thing we've changed inside the Beltway is a single driver during rush hour is prohibited today from going on 66. All we're saying is we will give that single driver an option. Instead of getting off on 50 and 29 and causing local congestion, you can stay on 66 if you want to pay to stay on it. This is a choice. So anyone who's on free today stays for free. The only thing I'm doing is giving a single driver the option. But so the House of Delegates and the General Assembly have said that we don't want any tolls at all. And here are the ramifications. So I've said if the House and the Senate vote it down and the Northern Virginia delegation says they don't want it, I'm trying to act in a bipartisan way, but I want every Northern Virginia resident to understand I'm the one, after 15 years, who has come up with a plan to solve the problem on 66. If we don't do inside the Beltway, it's highly unlikely that outside the Beltway will happen. So you can go for another 15 years with no action on the most congested road in the most congested region in the country. I know members of the General Assembly say, oh, we'll send this bill so we can say we're not for tolls, and we hope the governor will veto it, and we can move forward. You know what? I'm not playing that game. I'm working in a bipartisan way to get things done. If they say they don't want it, the next important project up is 64, which is another top priority for me. I'm going to do what people want me to do. But I've laid out a plan. They have no plan. And they want to hide behind this bill to say I'm voting against tolls. But if we don't move forward on 66, let me be very clear. That is not my responsibility. I put a plan out. It is your legislators who have said no. They will own this. So we will be stuck on traffic once again for a very, very long time. I am trying to be a problem solver. I have a solution. They're trying to hide and duck. You know what? You got to stand up.
You recently returned from a trade mission to Cuba. Tom Sherwood also went to Cuba recently, and he had a list of accomplishments there. What have you accomplished there? What kind of business are you hoping to do in Cuba?
Well, I'd love, obviously, and we've done business there in fairness, Kojo, for 13 years. We've sold about $400 million of ag products. If we got full normalization, we could sell a lot more ag products down there, you know, let it be poultry and wine and soybean and apples would be a huge opportunity. But I took 20 business leaders with me, and they already negotiated deals, an aquaculture company, a wood flooring company. This is a nation of 11 million people who is dying to do business with us. This, I think, presents us a tremendous opportunity. Yeah, and you know what? Guess we might be able to bring some Havana Club rum back to America, and maybe a few Cuban cigars. So
I have some in my own. I have some in my own home. You know,
that's one of his accomplishments.
I think that was the accomplishment.
Yeah, I might have a little too there, Tom.
Governor Mayor Bowser here from the district, and Ike Leggett, the Montgomery County Executive. They're going to Cuba on February 20th for 5 days. They're going as part of the Latin American Chamber of Commerce, Greater Washington Latin American Chamber of Commerce. What's your specific advice to the two elected leaders? What surprised you that they should know?
Well, I would say this, and we had a lot of meetings. We brought some great businesses with us. Understand, the Cubans want to do business. I have said publicly, I think this policy is foolish. It's been around for 50 years. Since you've been there, Tom, you know this. Every other country in the globe is there doing business. Canada's there building resorts. Germans, where I met them in the lounge. China's over there looking at offshore drilling. We are missing out on this gigantic market that's open to us. So my advice is, listen, as I did, I mean, we spent hours and hours in meetings. Be respectful. They want to do business with us. But listen, I'm a huge advocate for ending the embargo. So we had a great relationship. In fact, the Minister of Foreign Trade from Cuba, who is in charge of all this, he and I had a lot of great conversations. I have invited him to come to Virginia, and I heard this morning that he may accept my invitation. So, you know, listen, to me, it's all about doing business. It's all about growing the economy. It's creating new jobs, and they want to do business with us.
I will say this. One thing I learned is that if Cuba were a state in the United States, given its size, it would be the eighth largest state in the United States. It's not just a little island off the coast of Miami there.
It'd be bigger in Virginia. It'd be bigger in North Carolina. We're 8.4 million. There are 11 million people. You're exactly right.
I don't know how much you know about this, Governor McAuliffe, but North Korea said today that it had arrested a University of Virginia student accused of hostile acts against the state in cooperation with the U.S. government. This is obviously a matter for the State Department, but do you know any more about what's going on there?
I don't. I myself saw this early this morning. I'm going to have a call into the State Department. I'm going to talk to the folks. Obviously, this is a University of Virginia student. He was over there on a five-day visitor tourist pass. But I don't honestly know any more than that, Kojo, than what you've had. And obviously, since he's a UVA student, we need to dig deep into this and find out exactly what happened. But you're right. It's a State Department issue, but, you know, it's also a Virginia issue because he's a UVA student.
All right, Governor, we don't have a minute here. Very quickly, national politics, you're supporting Hillary Clinton. She's having a tough time in Iowa. What would you recommend to her to move that ball along down there?
Yeah, I think she's going to win Iowa.
And Tim Kaine might be a vice presidential nominee if she's the nominee.
We got two great senators. I'm pushing both of them, so I don't like to pick on my senators. We got two great ones. Listen, she can get things done. There are a lot of issues in the globe today, Tom. She's prepared to handle any one of them. She can win the general election. We have probably three Supreme Court justices going to retire over the next term of the president.
Can Bernie Sanders carry Virginia if he's the nominee?
I think he'd have a very hard time carrying Virginia.
I don't think no is the answer, probably. You just don't want to say it.
Terry McAuliffe is the governor of Virginia. I'm afraid that's all the time we have. Governor McAuliffe, thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you, guys.
Tom Sherwood, he's our resident analyst. He's a reporter with NBC4 and a columnist for the Current newspapers. Tried to stay both warm and safe this weekend.
Tried to give the correct answer.
Thank you all for listening. I am Kojo Nnamdi.